welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. You know, we say that at the beginning of every single program, and it's as true today as it was 11 years ago when we first started doing this program on September 7th of 2007. It's still just as true today. We are looking for those new ways of living. We're wanting to give you those choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we are encouraging you to go to our guest's website. We will be giving that to you shortly so that you can continue your evolutionary process. When's the program on, you ask? Since you've probably just tuned in for the very first time, well, it's on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. on this station, as well as Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And the program is streamed live at that time. There's a link on my website, so you can listen to the program at that time, or you can go to the podcast. That's right, podcasts. I'm slowly working archives out of my vocabulary, okay? And they're at SoundCloud, iTunes, the radio show's page of richarddugan.com, Stitcher. I don't know where they came up with that name, but there you go. We're working to expand to some other outlets as far as our podcasts are concerned, trying to find them. And I know they're out there, and all I have to do is take the what they call the RSS code. I know that means something, but I have no clue as to what it stands for. Take that code and then embed it into whoever's podcasting service, like iTunes and SoundCloud. And then it's available to all those folks who are tied into that particular thing. So we are encouraging you to go to the website, go to the radio show's page, the podcast, et cetera, because sometimes these programs, they go a lot longer than just the regular 50 minutes that we are allotted on the radio broadcast. And then we also would really appreciate your support and your help. There's a PayPal link on our website at the homepage and on the missions page. If, in fact, you are listening for the first time and you'd like to know more about what we're all about, go to the missions page, and it's kind of laid out there for you. A little bio on me and then information as to why we're doing what we're doing. And yes, I suppose you could say we're trying to change the world. One guest at a time, one person at a time, and eventually that will happen so that this place is a better place for everybody. We don't want to exclude anybody. Everybody should be able to fulfill their dreams, their life's purpose. And today is no exception as far as our guest is concerned, who's going to assist us in that process. And she's right up our alley, so to speak, with a work that she's put out that we're going to be talking about, along with, as always, lots of other stuff. New Insights and Inspiration for Writers. The title is The Story Within. And we'll have her tell her story, share that with us here on the program. And we certainly hope that you will stay with us for the entire broadcast. We want to welcome Laura Oliver to our program. And she is an MFA. What's MFA? Laura, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, Richard. And MFA stands for Masters of Fine Arts.
Okay, now you're going to have to help me because I've only been to junior college. And I've watched a number of people in the last 13 years that I've lived here in Santa Barbara go after their PhD and get it. Mm-hmm. Where does the PhD fall in reference to, say, I know a bachelor's is usually the first kind of degree that one would get. It's just a basic thing.
So, exactly.
And then what's next?
The master's follows the Bachelor of Arts, and then you get a master's, and it could be in any discipline. Mine happens to be in fine arts because it's actually a master's of fine arts in creative writing and literature. And then PhD programs are beyond that. My program is terminal, though. It always sounds terrible. It sounds like a disease that you're not going to recover from, but it actually means there are very few programs that offer doctorates in writing. Most people consider the master's degree as far as you would go in formal education in the field of writing.
You know, this whole aspect of writing one's story. I mean, I have a short little bio that I send out every once in a while to people who ask for it for different things I'm doing. Short little bio on my website on the missions page about how I got where I am today. And sometimes I'm going, how did that happen, you know? But it's actually putting it into words that are interesting, mm-hmm. that people want to listen to. I joke about how if my life were a reality show, mm-hmm. I wouldn't watch it. It's just from the standpoint of watching my life unfold, it's just not that interesting. I'm having a great time. I'm excited about my life, but I wouldn't sit and watch it because then I'm not living my life. You know, that kind of is really where that comes from, is that when we start watching these kinds of programs, and for that matter, in one sense, sort of reading about other people's lives, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, the time that you're sitting there reading about somebody else's life and what they went through and everything, you could be out there doing exciting things at the same time. When you read about somebody else's life,
well, I can often use justifications for why you would read about somebody else's life, including exactly. why I would read about yours.
Ah, well, to me, you get inspiration, you get yeah. insight, you learn learn about the lessons that they went through, and maybe, unlike with your parents saying, "I want you to do what I tell you, not what I've done, because I want you not to make the mistakes I made." And right. maybe you can minimize that, maybe not, because you know we do learn from our mistakes. But in terms of sitting down and saying, you know, Laura, I think that I've got something I want to say in reference to maybe a part of my life. You know, there were 5 years back in the day. When I went through this particular experience and I learned this particular lesson, and it was really profound, and I don't know if that'll fill a book or not, and I don't know how big the book has to be. And I mean, these are the kinds of questions that start to come up with someone who is even contemplating putting down. And then the other thing, too, is you see a lot of people who start writing what they call their memoirs. Mm-hmm. And my opinion is anybody writing their memoirs who's younger than 60 mm-hmm. is going to have to write them again. They're going to have to do volume 2. And I say, of course, I mean, we don't know when our time is up. That's true. But at the same time, I'm sitting here. I'm 58. And you know, I've got a lot of stuff out there, not in book form, but like I said, a little bio. And I've just got so much more life that I want to live. I told people I'm going to live to be 100. I have to outlive my great-grandmother who died at 100.
Oh.
So I got 42 years to go. I mean,
the
now,
genes.
To me, is not the time to write my memoirs. You know, maybe in my 80s. But where would somebody begin when they're asking all of these questions about whether or not I should, whether it's going to be interesting, or how do I make it interesting, et cetera, et cetera. Where does one begin with telling one's own story in, and I'm going to say it this way, in print?
Okay. First of all, I think everyone has a story, including you, and even a 20-year-old can write a memoir, because if you've survived your childhood, as Flannery O'Connor would say, you've got something to write about.
Yeah.
But what do we want to read? We want, just as you said, to read about how other people solve the problem of being alive. We are actually biologically wired to respond to story. When I say the words, "Richard, I have a story to tell you," your brain actually releases a rush of dopamine at the idea that intriguing information is on the way. And that information might help you in some way survive without actually having to go through whatever it is I'm about to tell you. Mm-hmm. So if somebody comes to me and they say, I have the instinct to tell my story, I have the impulse and the desire, but I'm not sure what my story is, I would say, let's go back and explore that. Let's look for a place in your life where there was trouble. Nobody really wants to read a story about how everything was just great and just fine and it was all perfect. Nobody cares. Nobody really cares, but we are very interested in how you solved a problem, even a problem of identity, even an emotional one. It doesn't have to be, you know, how I survived being lost on a mountain overnight in a snowstorm. It can be something much more subtle. But we're all far more alike than we are different. And what interests you probably interests me. And what you fear, I probably fear too. And what you figured out, I'd really like to go on that journey with you.
Well, I know that's part of why we do this program and have so many different and diverse people on this program is because I don't have all the... I could sit here and pontificate for 13, 14 years, but that's not going to go very far because I'm not actually adding any information to my knowledge base. So we have other folks on, like yourself, to talk about ways in which we can improve our situation in life.
Yeah.
And I know that part of that is actually getting some of this stuff out, even if it's hard, even if it's the dark side.
Yeah, especially if it's the dark side. And you're absolutely right. How can we grow? How can we improve ourselves, our lives, our situations, our relationships? Writing is a phenomenal tool. I mean, I teach people writing as a craft. How to write a novel, how to write a memoir, how to write a great short story, how to get it published in a national literary review. But I also teach writing as a tool for healing grief, for recovering the lost self, for changing the story within. You know, a lot of us have an identity, a story we tell ourselves and other people about who we are that's not actually authentic anymore. It's a story that wasn't even written by you, Richard. It was written by someone in authority when you were a little kid who told you who you were. You know, you're the quiet one, or you're the loud one, or you're the athletic one. Well, maybe you're not. Maybe that was never true. So writing is always a process of discovery, in my experience. The best writing carries a process of discovering. You don't sit down to say, I'm going to teach everybody what I know, because nobody cares what you know. You're only an authority on your own experience. And that's something we want to hear about.
Well, then there are other types of writing, aside from doing one's memoirs, if you will, or their own life story, their own history. And there are certain aspects of someone's story. There might be, okay, I'm 58, and I could tell you about specific instances in time where I could go into incredible detail about just maybe a 10 or 15 minute period in my life that happened. And that could fill, I don't know, 30, 40 pages.
Sure.
Maybe maybe an entire book in just that 5 or 10 minutes, you know. One of the, and I'm curious about this from not only your experience, but that of others that you've shared with and you've worked with. How does one, because I know that I'm guilty of this, write about oneself honestly and objectively without being, without even in the writing process, even in the first draft, just jotting stuff down without self-editing because, you know, well, you know, I was with somebody else and I don't want to upset them and this and that and the other thing. And I don't know that I want to reveal that much about myself. And I did this and that and the other thing. I mean, it wasn't that it was illegal or anything, but some people might find, in other words, I start thinking from the perspective of what are other people going to think? Oh, I better not say it that way. I better rephrase it, or I better change the scenario. And this, in other words, the editing that goes on, even as we're just trying to get the information down.
Right. We're all self-censors. And I have to laugh because that's part of why I went to graduate school, was to learn to write fiction, because I wanted to write about my life, but I no longer wanted to claim all of it in public as me. So that was funny, as how I had to kind of learn to do both, to handle both genres. I think, though, when I'm advising the people I mentor who come to me for writing help, I tell them write with abandon. You know, emotional honesty carries a charge in it, and it makes the difference between stories that you read or essays that you read and say, oh, that was good, and the ones you read that you hand to a friend and say, you have got to read this. And the difference is the level of emotional honesty. And yes, that means self-disclosure. But the thing is, I tell people, write with abandon. In my book, I say, in The Story Within, that personal critic, I call the PC, just make friends with that person, that critic. Just say, you know you think you're protecting me. I know you're here censoring everything I write to keep me from embarrassing myself publicly. But just pull up a chair and sit down and just take a seat on the side here for a minute, because I'm going to write with abandon. just write it all because no one has to see it until you're ready for them to see it. So in the first phase, you don't edit as you go. You just write with abandon for as long as you can, and then the editing comes later. It's completely safe, which means writing in a safe place. It means feeling like your writing is private, that not someone's not going to come up and, go through your work until you're ready to share it. But I think that's the ticket, to write with abandon.
My guest is Laura Oliver. She is a writer. She has written at least the work we're talking about and alluding to is The Story Within, New Insights and Inspiration for Writers. And the website that I want to send you folks to is lauraoliverwriter.com. We will be linked to that website as well, so we certainly hope that you will avail yourselves. Now, you're an award-winning fiction, as well as you've written award-winning fiction as well as essays.
Yep.
And you've been writing for how long?
I'd say I started writing seriously when I was about 35.
Wow. And what happened at that moment in your life when you said, I should be writing, or I want to write, or
I
what
can tell
was
you
it?
exactly the moment. I had been writing previously. I went to college. My undergraduate degree was in English, and I went to college to be a writer, and I was writing old stuff that no one would have, I certainly would have thought was very good looking back. But when I was 35, I had my last child, and I think that in a way, knowing that you've come to the end of a creation period in your life of physical creation, I knew that child would be my last. That sort of opened the gates then for creation on other levels. And a writer friend of mine wrote to me and said, "Hey, send me a story about having that last child. What was that experience like?" And it was suddenly I had an assignment. And suddenly, a lot of creative energy could go onto the page that had probably been spent trying to make it through pregnancies and child rearing and diaper changing. And it was the first essay I ever wrote where I made that spiritual shift from writing about what I knew to making a discovery on the page. Something happened in that essay where I learned something I didn't know about myself. And I never looked back. From that moment on, I truly got it, what it means to for writing to be a process of discovery.
I have to send out, I guess you'd call it a shout out. He's long since passed away, I'm sure. But I have to send out kudos and great appreciation to my Southwest literature instructor, a teacher in high school, Mr. Miller. Because it was in his class that I began to creatively write. And he was extremely supportive. At times, there were times when he was a little critical, but I remember one story in particular, which I still have the original that I hand wrote. And it was a fictional story, and it was actually a story within a story, sort of, about, similar to what you've experienced, winning awards for the work that you've done. And the long and the short of it is that there were these two authors. One was like 19, entering his very first competition, and one was 60, 70 years of age, entering the same competition for like the 10th or 12th or 14th time, having never won it. And the 19-year-old won it. That absolutely enraged the 70-year-old to the extent that he was going to get his revenge. Well, that evening, they were holding a celebration for that winner and the others in other genres. And so he, the 70-year-old, decided he's limber enough to wear, agile enough. He rented or stole or what have you one of these motorized rubber boats, the things that inflate.
Yeah,
And
inflatable.
he went out to the yacht that was about half a mile offshore where they were celebrating having a grand time. And he had taken with him explosives. And he got into his swim. He was in a diver's outfit, what have you, and he swam towards the yacht. He actually encompassed the entire hull of the yacht with these explosives, set the timer, swam back to his boat, and just as he gets into his boat, the yacht explodes, killing everyone. All right. One thing he didn't count on, though, was the explosion tossing debris in the air, and it began to come rain down upon him, puncturing his little boat. Well, with all of the dead bodies and the blood and what have you, it drew the sharks, and of course he was attacked and killed in the process. Well, the real irony of the story is that the 70-year-old's story that he submitted was that story.
Very clever.
Sort of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
And I still I don't remember the exact words. I'd have to pull the story out. But my instructor, he really liked that. And I've often thought of pulling that out and expanding on it in some way, shape, or form.
You should, if you have the impulse to do it, or you should be writing more fiction.
Well, that's one of the things that I did in photography class in college. I would take pictures of different things, strange-looking things out in the, you know, in the city when I was living in Phoenix. Then I would develop them, put them on photo paper, put them on a mat board, and then take a piece of ruled paper, tape it to the back, and then write a story about that picture. But it wasn't necessarily about that picture as it actually was. It was a fictional story.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of fun as well. But I know that a lot of people have trouble with that because they get sometimes, do you ever find this in yourself, or do you find it with people you're teaching, that they get caught in they find it difficult to write fiction, maybe, or be fictional in a storytelling, because of their belief systems, that, oh, no, can't go there because. Can't write about that because that goes against everything that I was taught as a child. At home, in church, you know, these kinds of things. The philosophies that you were raised by. Have you ever found that to be in the way?
I think it's the opposite. I think people write so that they can
contradict
what they were taught were the rules. I mean, writing is a safe place where you can do that and do it with impunity. Yeah, you get to experiment. You know, maybe you were raised Catholic, but you want to experiment with what it would be like to be raised with no faith whatsoever. So you can write a story about that, experience it on the page, and maybe even learn something in the process or open a door for someone else.
You talk about not only obviously writing fiction, but you also do, of course, as we are discussing here, writing about one's own personal story.
Right.
When you're considering that and you start putting stuff down and you're able to, you know, stop the self-editing, you know, say, tell the editor, go take a coffee break. Come back later. I'm going to write while you're off getting coffee. Okay. Get
or
me one with
hike.
Cream. Or take a hike. Yeah. Take a hike, pal. But what about including other people? I mean, because obviously we are associating with all kinds of people in our lives, and it's kind of hard not.
The story. You mean how about including other people in the story?
Exactly.
Without that's a problem. You know,
crossing that line.
Yeah, they often say, you know, I want to write a memoir, but I can't until everybody I know is dead.
I've heard that. I've heard that.
It would be so incriminating, or at least until my parents are dead, you know, since most of us have elements of our childhood, you know, the damage we're dragging along with us into adulthood, you know,
right.
We know who the culprits were. But, you know, I can only say, I have to say, I kind of feel like Anne Lamott does about this, which is, if you create drama in my life and you're in my life, well, the chances are you are going to show up in my writing. And I just kind of feel like that's fair. Certainly not to reveal secrets about other people, but I think it's fine to tell the world how other people affected you. You know, that's where it's okay. It's in that a chemical process where I may not reveal things about you, Richard, but I can tell how you, Richard, affected me. And that's fair.
Mm. And that's, in a manner of speaking, safe, you know?
Yeah.
I know that, you know, we've had some very interesting books pop out in the last 2 years due to our outward experiences religiously as well as politically, because I know those are coming as well. Mm-hmm. And these people write these books, like, for example, very well-known reporters. They're writing these books based upon the information they've gathered. And you sit there and you hear all kinds of backlash. That's not true, and this and that. It's like, wait a minute. How are you going to challenge that? Because I'm quoting somebody else who said you said.
Yeah.
All right? Now, yeah. It's not so much going down that direction from the legal standpoint as far as libel and or slander. By the way, I'm trying to remember, which one goes with which? Libel goes with spoken and slander goes with written?
No, it's the reverse. Slander is when I say something negative about you. Libel is when I say something that you can prove, when I've written something that you can prove caused you harm.
Ah. I know that I figure that the individual who has a problem with that has probably done themselves sufficient harm having said what they said. My revealing it usually is not going to make it much worse. But right. Nonetheless, I know that there have been lawsuits and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
What about, and this is sort of getting into some of the details here, because I know you hold workshops all over the place and you're wanting to get people to do this. And I have to tell you that a few years back, I was really concerned about my ability, because I'm such a slow reader due to my vision, that I'm so thankful for Audible books.
Oh, yeah. I love Audible books.
Well, I finally finished Stranger in a Strange Land. I have the hard version, the print version at home, and I was trying to read through it, and finally I found it on Audible, and I listened to it. I must have re-listened to several chapters over and over again because I forgot where I was.
Right.
I was a little disappointed in the ending myself. I loved the story overall. Absolutely incredible detail. But what I wanted to get to was quoting. Of other people, but even those who have long since gone, and the subject of plagiarism. Mm-hmm. How do we avoid that when we keep on this program? I'll make all kinds of quotes from other people that I've heard saying this and that and the other thing, mm-hmm. and I try to remember who it was that said it so that I can give them credit.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of putting it down in print, how does one avoid really ticking off that person or the ancestors thereof? Say, hey, that was not yours. That was someone else's. Do you just basically give the credit for that quote to that person and you're fine?
Yeah. If you can paraphrase, mm-hmm. instead of trying to quote, and paraphrasing, then you're completely safe. And if you're going to quote, if something was published prior to 1927, you can just go ahead and quote it without having to buy the rights to do that or get permission. It gets a lot more expensive and complicated, anything published after 1927 when the copyright law changed. There is a concept called fair use that says anything under, say, I think 140 words, I can use even if it was published yesterday without paying for it. But it doesn't apply to things like song lyrics or poems, because a poem, the whole impact could be in two lines. So it's a complicated thing. I usually don't worry about it, because if you're publishing something, the publisher is going to make sure that you that the work complies with whatever those laws are. And the work I'm usually writing or mentoring is creative, and so there isn't so much need to be quoting other people.
Do you find that some people want to write because they think their story is so great that they will win an award, Pulitzer or a Peabody or something along the way, even a lesser known award of sorts? And sometimes, for whatever reason, sometimes maybe that's their motivation. Oh, it's so great that I know I'll win. I'll get noticed and win and so forth. And I mean, yeah. I don't know what the odds are, but
odds are really slim. The odds are sort of like, I'm going to take a plane trip from here to California, and I'm going to happen to sit next to an editor for Random House, and I'm going to happen to mention that I'm a writer, and she's going to give me a six figure advance. I mean, that's happened once in a while, but it's not likely. So I do, yeah, everybody I work with, I think, harbors that dream, that I'm going to write the next great American novel, or I'm going to write a best-selling memoir, and it's going to be made into a movie with, Julia Roberts and Robert Redford. Everybody has that dream, to be on stage. I get a lot of people, I think, nowadays wanting to write books because books are vehicles by which you then can justify doing a TED Talk or being on stage somehow. And I think we have such a need to tell our stories, and a lot of us want to connect physically as well. So a lot of times I think I get people wanting to write books who really want to use the book as a vehicle to something else. But to answer your question, sure. Heck, I'd like to be, I'd like to win a Pulitzer myself. Do I think I will? No. Do I think I have the talent to do that? No. But there's nothing wrong with having the dream.
I've often found it in this context of art, that it's so subjective. It's like, well, okay, you liked it. It's like with movie reviewers, I never trust them. If they say they hated the movie, I'm probably going to love it, and vice versa.
I would go on Rotten Tomatoes and just see what the critics said and then see what the public said.
There you go. There you go. I mean, there have been, for example, my wife and I went to see, we've seen several of the, in the last 10 years, we've seen several of the M. Night Shyamalan movies. And I remember seeing one of the trailers on TV about it. And I'm going, because I'm not into horror films. I do not like scary movie films. I just don't.
They're
But
hard
I,
to forget
yeah,
once
they
they're in
are.
your head
Yes,
and you're
like,
home alone.
I can't unsee that now. I'm going to
Yeah,
sleep with the lights
exactly.
on. Matter of fact, I'm going to have floodlights and searchlights put in my home so that I'll never be scared again. But I saw the promo and I'm going, I don't know. That doesn't look like something I'd be interested in. Well, I acquiesced because we'd seen a couple of his other movies but prior to that. I said, all right, okay, fine, we'll go. And it's like the trailer wasn't even close to what the story was in the movie.
Oh,
One of my
no problem.
favorite, what, but one of my favorite things that happened in the theater at the end of that movie, and I still laugh about it to this day, from all the way back in the back row of the theater, you heard some guy saying, "Is that it? Is that it?" And I'm going, "He didn't get it. He just didn't get the message that M. Night Shyamalan was trying to portray, to get across in the movie." Unlike when I went to see the Blair Witch Project, when I found out what it really was, I was mad. I was so ticked that it was fake. I'm going, are you kidding me? And I sat there.
It was fake. I didn't know that was fake.
I got sucked into that so badly.
Apparently, so did I.
Well, and I was so ticked. Oh my God. It's like I never would have, and then also it's very important to be aware of the title of a movie. I am also not a fan of zombies. Now, people keep talking about the zombie apocalypse coming, and I'm not prepared, and I'm going, then I'll be the first one taken, and I'll be coming after you. I went to see the Brad Pitt movie Z War, I think is what it was called, or Z World. It was either Z World or Z War. And the letter Z in the front there did not tip me off, and so we went to see it in the theater. And I'm just going, oh, well, am I an idiot? Well, but I sat through it.
Good time to read a review.
But that's another thing, too, about books. And you can't judge a book by its cover. And I know that publishing houses and so forth, they try to come up with all kinds of fancy-looking covers to attract you to that bookshelf in that particular category and genre to get you to at
That's
least
true.
pull the book out and take a look at the cover, and maybe you'll open it up and flip through and so forth. And of course, I never was really intrigued by the print on the inside of a book per se. Because I'm such a slow reader, and of course, for the better part of my life, I was legally blind, so it wasn't something that really. If it had pictures in it, then you got my attention.
Yeah, and Audible is just a
Oh,
miracle as far as that goes.
and I love producing Audible too. I have produced a number of Audible books, children's book that we did some years ago with the author who came in and recorded. It's like grandma reading to the grandkids.
Absolutely.
And the book, folks, if you want to look it up at Amazon, it's Ghost Girl in Car Number 9. There's a five-minute, yeah, there's a five-minute collage of the audio book in there that you can listen to and get a sample of. But they're so much fun to produce, but they're even more fun to listen to. The one I'm in the middle of, I'm not even in the middle of it. I've barely begun it over and over again. I've barely begun it, is the Audible of Ulysses.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
What a great way to take in a book that might be dense if you were reading it. That might be a more palatable way to take it in.
Well, as I was, I think, alluding to earlier, I made the observation that every day, every week, every month, every year, hundreds and hundreds of books are published. Mm-hmm. I have scratched the surface. I've scratched the scratch of the surface when it comes to the classics, okay? I mean,
yeah,
I've only finished Stranger in a Strange Land. I'm working on some other spiritual books like the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and the Ramayana and those kinds of things. I've actually physically read, but I also had a cassette version of the... A cassette version of the Bible that I used to listen to back in the 80s and 90s. And other more spiritual books in audible form.
Mm-hmm.
And I find those so fascinating, especially one that was given to me at the age of 21 that I actually carry around with me just about everywhere, called The Impersonal Life. And I found it on Audible as well. I even recorded it back in, I think it was 83, 84. I recorded it on reel-to-reel. I still have the reel-to-reels of my version. But
I'll look it up. What is it, The Impersonal Life?
The Impersonal Life by James Benner. Banner. In 1930s, it was in the 30s that it was originally published. And just to give folks a real quick synopsis, it's, I guess you could say it's like God talking to you, the reader, as you're he's actually you who are reading this book now. You who have picked up this book and opened the book and paid, you are ready for this information that you are about to embark on, and so on and so on and so on. And it goes into lots of different subjects, including reincarnation, which I found fascinating because, and this is something I wanted to get into with you as well, in terms of someone who, okay, I have my story, but I had this experience that that opened my eyes and enlightened me and so on and so forth. And even though that was my experience, I'm an individual, and it probably will never happen for anybody else of the 7.6 billion people on the planet. I need to get this out because who knows, maybe it will happen for at least one more other person. You know, it might apply. It might work. Are there any kind of techniques that one uses to attract, or do we take it at face value, as many people have said on this program, about whether it's books, movies, individuals, experiences, you're going to be drawn to it if you're kind of there, like even when it comes to fiction, for that matter?
Well, if I understand your question, I think we first of all, we tend to read the kind of things we want to write. And so, and you are always, your intuition's always tuned towards the things that, I always say, pay attention to what you pay attention to. You know, those things that capture, whether it's a subhead or it's a review or it's passing in a bookstore and it's somebody has written, this is our staff favorite, and a little synopsis. And you're drawn to those things. I think reincarnation is a vast, fascinating subject, as one of many, and as one, along with everything else in terms of spirituality and the intersection of science and spirituality and religion, all those things together. Nobody knows how the world works for sure. We don't know all of the answers. You know, Einstein knew a piece, Newton knew a piece, and every day we learn a new piece. So, writing and reading are ways in which we can absorb as much as possible of what's new and what other people are experiencing. I mean, reincarnation, I told my mother when I was 5 that I wasn't going to go to kindergarten because I'd had it in my last life.
She didn't buy that one, I'll bet.
No, I went anyway. Twice, apparently.
Don't! Well, this is fascinating. We're going to continue our conversation here with Laura Oliver, MFA, and the story within. You have one, I have one, we all have one. And we also have a break coming up. Stay tuned. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We'll be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And here we are right back with Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices. Those choices are that you can write it down or not. It's entirely up to you. You don't have to, but you never know who you might touch. And if you're in the business, in a general sense, if your life's purpose is about serving others, then part of that service is sharing those messages. You know, Laura Oliver, author of The Story Within, one of my favorite authors, James Redfield, who wrote The Celestine Prophecy, talked about that we all have messages for one another. Talk to us from your perspective about how important it is to write down our individual stories so that they might be available to others.
Well, a lot of people approach me nowadays. I think in particular, there's a burgeoning baby boomer population that is now starting to say to themselves, hey, I'm on the last quarter, of my life. No matter how I look at it, no matter how great my genes are, chances are I'm in the last quarter. And they want to write their stories down hugely for their grandchildren, for their children. Most of the time, there's this feeling that no one really knew me. And a lot of things happened to me that no one knows about, or things happened to me that were so remarkable, or such periods of growth that I want to capture those and put them on the page. So people write their stories down for others as a way to cherish the past, as a way to immortalize the past, as a way to share the past. But people also write their stories down to figure things out. You know, the quote, how do I know what I think until I see what I say, is really true. I think Arlene Croce said that. Maybe it's E.M. Forster. How do I know what I think until I see what I say? And you're putting stuff on the page, and by and golly, 9 times out of 10, you'll make a discovery about yourself. So there's so many reasons to write your story down, whether it's for yourself and your own personal growth and new awareness, self-awareness, or whether it's to pass on to someone else.
Mm. I know that my mother began working several years ago, and I have a copy of it, primarily the story regarding the genealogy. I think from her side of the family.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. I've had my DNA tested, so now I'm in a database somewhere, and a relative who crosses the line will be found because they'll find my DNA, their DNA. It's, exactly. Oh, through Richard, we can get to this guy or this gal, and they're toast.
Yeah. criminals possible here.
Exactly. But it's not just, sometimes it isn't just about your story. Because again, our stories are so interwoven into one another.
That's true.
That it's
That's
hard
true.
Not.
Your story is probably your parents' story and your siblings' story. And yet, you know what? I don't know if you have siblings, but you'll find that if they were to write their memoir and you wrote yours, you would think you didn't even grow up in the same household.
Well, and see, that's what's interesting is how if you can approach their memoir from an open-minded and objective perspective, it might knock loose some memories that you, I don't know, maybe repressed or you forgot about.
Absolutely. Because the thing about memory that we now know about memory is so unreliable. I mean, we now know that the brain changes your memory every time you remember something. They did research on survivors from 9/11 and interviewed these people immediately after, 6 months after, and a year after, and their stories changed remarkably over time. Because every time you remember an event, you bring to that memory everything that has happened to you since the last time you remembered it and the present moment. And these things alter. So, I mean, your sister's going to tell you the family car was blue when you knew it was green. And, she's going to be just as convinced of her truth as you are of yours. And who knows where the actual truth lies.
Or my chocolate bunny rabbit didn't melt in the back of the station wagon. It melted in the middle seat where she sat.
Exactly, or else ate it.
or else ate it.
And has been denying it ever since.
And by the way, that station wagon was actually blue-green.
Yeah, there you go.
But at the same time, I think that it also can help to bring siblings who may have been estranged or just haven't had a lot of contact with one another over the many years, could bring them close together. Oh, really? You remember that? Well, I kind of remember it this way. And then you kind of start putting those pieces together, and it opens things up, you know, and who knows what's next. Now, let's talk about that in the light of our technology today, and that, I swear, just about everything's being videoed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, no. It didn't happen that way as you wrote it in your book. Look, I've got the video right here from 2018. Mm-hmm. Look, see, this is what happened. And see, the colors are, and you did this, and I did that, and she did that. This is the other thing was, for example, I know social media is the general term, but a lot of people there, for example, I just had the passing in October of 2018 of my dear dog, Makushla, beautiful 16-year-old female white shepherd husky mix.
Oh, and, my condolences.
Oh, well, it's just one of those things that happens. She was 16. She was a caregiver.
Yeah.
Well, I was fortunate enough when we acquired Angus, who is 6 years old now. I took videos of the two of them, especially at his 8-week-old stage. And there she is as the mother taking care of him at her age of 10. And they are just having a grand time. And I have... 25 videos up on my website. You can go to the homepage. You see a picture of her. You click on that picture, and it takes you to those videos. And I got a comment from someone who said, it's so great that you had the foresight, which it really wasn't, to take the videos of the two of them playing and her raising him and so on and so forth. But I put that up there because I wanted people to see how she worked and played, because you could see the mother in her come out every so often, even at that early stage of 8 or 9 weeks, disciplining him.
Oh.
But at the same time, they just were, and her tail's wagging like you wouldn't believe. So she was a caregiver. And so here I've got these wonderful stories about this beautiful girl that took care of an elderly dog before his passing in 2007. Took care of another dog and unfortunately watched him pass after he was bit by a rattlesnake in, I think, 2012. Mm-hmm. And then raising of Angus up until October of this past year. And so I've got all these wonderful stories, but I'm thinking, you know, the videos really, they speak a lot more than I could ever say in words.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that people might... get to that kind of a stage, or are people saying, look, I got the video, I don't need to put this down into words?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think we are hungry for stories, and that stories are words, and words are powerful. And I think that pictures are fine and movies are fine, but all those movies started out as books, invariably. They were bestsellers first. And I think our need to express ourselves with words is only going to become greater, not lesser. So, I don't think video is going to take away from that. It may add on a new layer, add on an additional experience. But I think in our basic core level, in the beginning was the word, and that the word is something that will remain and will be the currency of our intimacy, the stories we exchange. What we disclose about each other so that we can feel safe and know each other will remain the story.
When writing one's memoirs, which is more important, the details and accuracy or the story?
I'd say the story, because in a memoir, again, there's no one can actually go back when you are writing a memoir and you repeat dialogue that you had, say, with your teacher. No one recorded that at the time. No one can say whether that's actually accurate. I always sort of say it's memoir-ish. It's not something we can actually say is a record. So the details add vibrancy. They add life. The details are what, especially sensory details, are what put me in your experience, what make me feel that I'm there experiencing what you experienced. But the story is still yours. The story is not just what happened, but why what happens matters. Mm. And that's the story.
How detailed should one get? Should we go down to the subatomic level?
You should be pretty detailed. I mean, you don't want to say car, you want to say Lexus. You don't want to say dog, you want to say Malamute. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to say candy, you want to say Snickers. You'd want to be as detailed as you can be, because that's what makes us visualize a story. We can't see abstractions, and we are not compelled by generalities.
I'm thinking that telepathy is just that. It's images. It's not going to be words we're going to hear or see, because if I can show you a picture, then you have the same understanding that I have. Certainly not the experiences based on that picture, because it was my life. Mm-hmm. You know, like showing you a picture of my dog. Okay. But at least now you've seen the dog. And so that's why. How does one learn do you get a thesaurus and a dictionary in order to be able to come up with as many different descriptive words to describe, like if I was going to describe my dog, in order to be able to do that? Yes, she was white, but sometimes she was just so much more than just white. She just vibrant.
Absolutely. Yeah, you may have been joking, but I'm not joking when I say, sure, a thesaurus and dictionary, sure, and especially on the computer, all you have to do is hold your cursor, you know, over a word, and you're going to find all the synonyms for it. That absolutely is helpful, but so is feeling into it. So is, like, when I want to write down something to show the reader that I was exasperated, I don't look up the synonyms for exasperated. I stop and I close my eyes and I feel into what happens in my body when I'm exasperated. I might even look in the mirror. What happens when I feel this way? What gesture do I make? How does my posture change? What happens on my face? So feeling into it is just as important as reaching for another word. But I am absolutely a fan of reaching for a better word. You know, Mark Twain said the difference between the right word and the wrong word is the difference between lightning and lightning bug.
Well, one of my favorite words I took from Stranger in a Strange Land is the word, I'll use it in the context as a verb, to grok.
To grok.
I grok this. I grok that. And I define it. What's that?
What's it mean?
Well, I define it this way. It is to assimilate the understanding deep into every cell of your being. That is to grok. Not just to, I get it. No, it is literally to take it in. And there's a phrase that's used throughout that particular book where they refer to one another as water brothers. Even women are referred to as water brothers. And they share water. But there's this ceremony. And apparently at one point, as you begin this path down this particular Martian spiritual path, you begin to... it's more than understanding. It's knowing that you know that you know deep inside, deep down. I mean, for example, when you fall in love with someone, I mean, really, head over heels, you know this is the right person, man, you just can't. And the feeling never goes away. That is a kind of grokking. You're grokking the emotion, the connection, the love of that person. And... I love that word.
Transformative, then, I guess, is
very,
what you're saying.
Very much so. Very much so. How have you, from your perspective, obviously, as opposed to someone else's, which is not here, seems kind of silly to ask it that way. How has this process for you of writing, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, etc., how's this transformed your life? And I don't use the word, I'm trying not to use the word change anymore, because it was shared with me in a program that, the word change implies that it can be changed back, but transform, that's kind of a more permanent thing, and it's sort of an upward spiraling thing. So what about your transformational process over the years since you started writing?
Well, writing itself is transformative and therapeutic, although it's not therapy. So in some ways, I would say what's been transformative about it is the things I've learned about myself that I might not have known had I not been writing, which is one of the reasons I would hope that all your listeners would consider writing, because it is a way to learn more about yourself. So there's that, but it's also an act of generosity. It's also transformative in that when I write something that makes someone else feel deeply moved and maybe be slightly kinder to somebody else or laugh out loud, that's transformative. You know, there's a brain thing that the basic brain stem, that reptilian part of the brain that we've had for millions of years, that's egocentric. And it sees all action as inner-directed. So when I'm kind to you, or when I write something, you know, generous and give it to someone else, I feel as if that's been done to me. Conversely, if I criticize, or I'm snippy, or I'm obnoxious, or I gossip about someone on the phone for an hour, I will never feel good when I hang up the phone. I'll feel vaguely as if I've been gossiped about or I've been mistreated. So there's this part of writing that is this loving, caring, self-disclosing, imaginative act of generosity that I think as it pours out, it comes back to you. And that in itself is transformative. We're lucky. We're lucky, we writers, that we get to have an art form that allows us to connect and fosters connection between others.
You know, that's something that, in spite of the fact that you and many, many others have been writing, that seems to be something that is missing in our world today. And we're seeing the separation on a regular basis in our world. And it's so frustrating from my perspective, because it's like, wait a minute. I learned many years ago that, and I came up with this analogy, that If the good Lord had intended for each one of us to live solitary lives, I'm pretty sure that amongst the trillions upon trillions upon trillions of planets that are out in the universe, there's one for each one of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, guess what? 7.6 billion of us are all right here on this little ball of dirt. So what that says to me is we're supposed to work together. We're supposed to connect and thrive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really thrive. Do you find that when you're writing, and I'm curious as to whether when you're writing, does that come across, or do you find sometimes when you're writing some of, especially the fiction, that aside from being therapy, is it an escape for you from the real world sometimes? Because I got to get away from this stuff and turn off the TV and throw away the papers, and I need to get into this other world, like Frank Herbert's Dune. I mean, to go there would be preferable to at times to being here.
Yeah, you know, I wish that were true for me, and every writer is different, and I certainly have friends who are novelists who write purely from their imagination, and it is an escape. That's simply not true for myself, speaking personally. Even my fiction has at its core some nugget of reality, something that happened to me that I really do want to explore or record. So it's much less an escape than it is an exploration.
Mm. I have to also say, too, and we were talking earlier about detail, when I read the Dune trilogies when I was, I guess, in my teens or 20s, I can't remember which, I not only was I enthralled by the story, but as the observer while I'm reading, I'm going, wow, I can't believe this guy went to that much trouble to create this whole new religion.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
The social structure and on and on. And the same thing with Stranger in a Strange Land. That whole thing. I mean, to me, that's totally different from Ulysses, which is a day in the life of Dublin, Ireland. You know.
Well, yeah. And I'm thinking Game of Thrones. And,
oh, my God. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, there's an entire language that's, you know, and I always think, are the actors just making that up as they go along, or is that written down? Amazing. Could you repeat it twice?
Would you please? It would help. It would really help. No, it's just incredible the minds that are out there. And yeah. And who knows, you listening, you could be the next mind out there that could write that next incredible story. And I have to tell you, I've been working on this little book of mine for 18 years. And
it should be awfully good when you're finished.
It's not, and it's not like I'm trying to rewrite or compete with War and Peace, which, by the way, I have not read yet.
Well, I don't think I have either, so that makes two of us.
I'm not sure it's in audible form yet, but it might be.
I'll get it.
I'd much rather read The Art of War. That's a much easier, the digestible piece than that. Or maybe try to finish Ulysses and then move on to the Upanishads and so forth. But it's fascinating what you can come up with. And when you're starting to write, oh, I got one for you. Yes, you talked earlier about, you know, when you're on the computer and you can hover over the word and mm-hmm. and get the thesaurus and or dictionary and so on and so forth. But what is your feeling about writing in longhand versus, I'm just going to, typing it into mm-hmm. the computer or third option, speaking it into your device using that speech recognition software that's available?
Right. Yeah, like Dragon. I think is one of those. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. I often have thought about experimenting with speaking it, but I actually like writing on the computer. It's faster. I can change things effortlessly. I can move paragraphs around. I can X things out or make them very, very tiny so that I can think about whether or not I want to keep them. Longhand, though, I think has a power in it. When we talk about using writing as a tool instead of writing craft, writing as a tool, I think, is really well served by writing in longhand. For instance, if you will simply in the morning write out how you want your day to go, just write the perfect day, that's imprinted in your brain, I think, more solidly than doing it on the computer. And it's sort of like placing an order. You know, today I am so grateful for the fact the sun is shining and I have lunch scheduled with Richard and I'm looking forward to that. You know, and by the end of the day, I will feel this, this, and this. I mean, it really is a method of imprinting that on your brain, because your brain wants to make your inner and your outer world match. So what you've just now placed inside by writing, your brain's going to remind you of and is going to draw your attention to experiences, events, and people that will make it true. So I think writing in longhand is an incredible tool. But in my opinion, it's more for the personal growth yeah. aspect. But it's up to each writer.
I know that the, I guess they call them, I don't know what to call these, the different generations anymore. But
X or millennial.
Yeah,
or,
drives yeah. me nuts. Because I could never figure out whether I was a member of the baby boomer generation or not.
You're born between 1946 and 1964, you're a boomer.
Oh, okay, then I'm in. I was born in 1960, so there you go.
Yep, you're a boomer.
But one of the things you said about writing down how you want your day to go does two things. Not only, obviously, what you just explained, but also it also gets you in the frame of mind of writing fiction, because that's really what you're writing. When you're starting out your day, this is how I want my day to go, at the front end, that's fiction.
That's true. It's something you're imagining.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
That's very
yeah.
cool.
Just change the I to Peter or Mary, and you've got a story.
Exactly right. I guess I should have also asked you in reference to blogs and what role they play in this whole area, because a lot of people there, and I'm not talking about Facebook where I'm at lunch and I snap a picture of my food and I write a little caption or what have you, or yeah. I tell you, oh, by the way, I'm headed for the shower and blah, 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 blah. But people who go on and they create a blog, a daily blog about maybe what's going to happen or what's happened in their life that day. Is yeah. that along the same lines?
Yeah, there are blogs that are, as you say, they are just pretty self-indulgent and sharing a lot of information no one cares about. But there are blogs that are absolutely supportive of a particular cause. I have a blog which is full of inspiring prompts and amusing anecdotes for writers who just wonder, what am I going to write about today? That's linked to my website. And other writers that I've worked with who've published books, say a memoir on nearly losing a son to heroin addiction, that writer has a blog that is supportive of other parents who are struggling with kids who are addicted. My friend Sherry Cormier has a blog, or is working on one, to support people who have lost someone through death unexpectedly and are still grieving. So blogs can be very, very helpful, and they're supposed to be benefit oriented to the reader. And that's the difference. Am I writing just about myself to be on stage, or am I writing because I have something I might just help you?
So. Yeah. Sherry's been on our program, and we're so grateful for that, and she shared with us that as well, and it's very interesting stuff, and we encourage people to check out that interview as well, as this one with Laura Oliver, who's been my guest here on the program. And again, Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard.
Laura Oliver, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. This has just been a lot of fun, and I know we could go on longer. You hold workshops all over the country in different places, and we encourage people to look you up at Laura OliverWrite.com. The story
writer,
with
it, writer, Laura writer, Oliver writer.
Beg your pardon. Laura Oliver Writer is the .com is the website. The book is the Story Within: New Insights and Inspiration for Writers. Okay, that's everybody, because we all can write in one form or another. I mean, Stephen Hawking, he didn't type. Okay,
that's right.
He didn't write in longhand. He spoke it, obviously. And the stuff he wrote is just unbelievable, and I only know that from the reviews. I haven't read any of his work yet. I'm waiting for the Audible.
Yeah,
I'm waiting for the Audible to come out. But this has been a lot of fun. And first of all, I want to thank you, and also encourage you. Should you ever find yourself here out on the South Coast, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. I'd like to learn a few more things about being able to finish this crazy little book I'm trying to finish and get it. If I have to self-publish, I will self-publish.
Well, you probably can send it to a traditional publisher. So I would love to come visit you at some point in time, if that's ever possible. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
Again, LauraOliverWriters.com is the website, the story within. We will be linked to your website so people can go straight there and find out more about you, Laura. And before I let you go, I have three final questions that I ask all of my guests. And again, thank you. The first question is, who is Laura Oliver?
Laura Oliver is a mother, writer, member of humanity who just wants to connect with others and help make this world a slightly better place.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to make people feel safer, happier, and be entertained, and perhaps learn something about themselves that will make the world a better place.
And what is your life's purpose?
To learn to be happy and to share that.
LauraOliverWriter.com is the website. Please go there. Please check out this information. We've had many guests on our program before, Laura, who've talked about storytelling, and that's really what we're doing, because we're telling our story in book form. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time. Love to Lal.